Support for KDLG comes from GCI, offering a variety of packages for TV, internet, wireless, or home phone service. More at gci.com.
This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, KDLG's weekly news magazine. It's Friday, Cinco de Mayo. We're very glad to have you with us here today. Coming up this week, the Togiak purse seine fleet might be wrapping up very soon. Just exactly how many fish have they caught this season?
My guess is in the 50 million fish range.
Fish and Game's Tim Sands joins for the latest. Pebble is making news this week with hints of a new advisory committee raising eyebrows, and also with what CEO Tom Collier says is their intent to resolve their dispute with EPA and move the project forward.
We'll prepare a permit application and file it, and everyone will have an opportunity to look at the project we're proposing, which, by the way, I think will be dramatically different from what most people think.
We'll travel up to Igiagig for an annual culture camp for the kids, sit down with the new magistrate judge at the Dillingham Court, and go backstage at dress rehearsal as dozens of young folk get ready for this year's spring musical.
Annie, Miss Hannigan's gonna catch you and give you the paddle.
That's all coming up after a look back at some of this week's news. A Grant Aviation Cessna 208 Caravan crashed Monday on a routine flight from Port Hyden to Perryville. The only occupant on the plane, 54-year-old Gabe Chinetti, was killed on impact. It took searchers several hours to find the wreckage Monday afternoon, and then state troopers began an effort to recover the body. That effort has been hampered by the tough location on a snowy mountain and the weather on the peninsula. Sergeant Luis Nieves said Tuesday that it's not clear what might have gone wrong.
I'm looking at the wreckage. I'm looking that it's a pretty significant impact into the side of a mountain where he's at, but as to cause, who knows at this point? Was it low visibility? Was it equipment failure? We don't know. NTSB has to determine that.
The crash site is to the south of the Chignecks. Chinetti was a dual citizen from Italy. He had flown with Grant since 2014, often along that route on the peninsula. Southeast Alaska woke to a series of strong earthquakes Monday morning. A 6.2 magnitude rattler shook at 4:31, about 60 miles northwest of Haines, just inside the Canadian border. It was followed by many aftershocks that morning. Some light damage was reported in nearby towns. The purse seine harvest Thursday was 2,800 tons in the ongoing Togiak herring fishery, bringing their total harvest to just under 14,000 out of 16,000 allowable tons this season. The fleet has been plugging along steadily since they opened last Friday, but to manager Tim Sands' eye, the herring seemed to be moving a little slower than usual. On a Tuesday flight, there was not a lot of spawning activity yet to be seen.
There was some washed-out spawn that had happened previously in Ungerleithlick Bay and behind Tongue Point. And I've talked to the spotter pilots, and that's about all they've seen. So there hasn't been as much spawn as we would have expected. And again, I lay that to, it's just a little bit colder than the herring would otherwise like it.
A dozen or so gillnetters are still fishing, but are well below their quota of 7,000 tons. Kim Williams of Dillingham, long a staunch adversary of the Pebble Mine, has been ousted from her job at New Namta Alukastai. The board says she is signing on to an advisory committee with Pebble, which neither Williams nor Pebble has publicly confirmed. New Namta board member Sharon Clark.
Kim's official day was on May 1st. Our board has met, and our position is, and has always been, no mine in Bristol Bay, and we're very strong in that opposition.
Williams said Thursday that her position on Pebble has not changed, and she had nothing but good to say about New Namta, its work, and her time there. The trusty Tusty ferry vessel has been delayed getting back into service yet again this spring. The state now says she won't sail until July 18th, at least a month later than was expected after the first delay. Meadow Bailey is a spokesperson for the Department of Transportation.
There was some discovery during its annual overhaul that there was additional extensive steel waste found in the engine room. So that repair will take about 2 months longer to complete.
Southwest communities along the Tusties route have complained that this delay seriously hampers their businesses, industries, and lifestyle. The Tustie was supposed to land at the new Chignik Bay dock sometime in mid-May. A young man was killed in Unalakleet this week when an ATV he was a passenger on crashed down an embankment. 24-year-old Kevin Bradley was found dead at the crash site just outside of the village. State troopers believe Ransom Bradley, also 24, was driving the ATV. Neither was wearing a helmet, and alcohol is believed to have been a factor. And spring breakup is underway. The Nenana Ice Classic tripod went down at exactly 12 noon Monday. The Kuskokwim Ice Classic tripod outside of Bethel fell yesterday, but remarkably, its clock kept ticking. More on this week's news can be found at our website, kdlg.org.
This one.
Okay. Oh, I don't think you're right for him. Hey, look at what I might have been. Hey, oh, took a bus to Chinatown. Hey, I've been standing on canal. Oh. And Bowery. Hey.
Oh,
she's standing next to me.
Hey.
I belong with you. You belong with me.
That's the highly acclaimed No-See-Em Singers at Culture Camp in Iggyogig this week. We'll have more from there in just a bit on this show. First, let's check in with Tim Sands, the area manager for the Togiak Herring Fishery. I tracked him down this morning for the latest. Tim, good morning. It sounds like this purse seine fleet may wrap up very shortly. What's the latest?
Yeah, good morning, Dave. They've got 2,800 tons left to go on the quota. So they took 2,800 tons yesterday. I don't think there's quite enough capacity today for them to take another 28. So we'll give them all of today, and then tomorrow we'll look at it and see where we're at and give them a little bit of time tomorrow to get enough capacity to take the rest of the quota without taking too much more.
Sure.
How many gill netters are still out there, and they probably aren't anywhere near their quota yet?
Yeah, they're not anywhere near their quota. I think there's still less than 1,000 tons. I think there's 11 of them out there now.
So they can keep fishing?
They'll be able to keep fishing and keep going at it, and I think there might be more gill netters coming after the same fishery's done.
This has been kind of a stress-free season so far. There was one incident there early on, but have you heard anything else about the fishing? Have they been able to find the herring they're looking for? Quality's been good, no big incidents?
You know, getting kind of mixed reports on the quality. Some people are saying it's not as good as they want it. Other people are saying it's great. So I don't know the real deal on the quality, but for the most part, I think they've been able to find the fish they want. You know, we haven't had really major storms that have prevented fishing, but we've had a lot of little kind of storms. It's storming over there today. I'm not sure if they're even able to fish today or not. And one of the things that they're telling me that these changes in pressure do is make the fish go away. And so it makes it harder to find fish. All day yesterday, I think they were having trouble finding fish. And then last night, it got really nice, and there was a bunch of fish available last night. And that happens a lot, that all day long there's nothing, and then in the evening it gets calm and nice, and then they'll be able to load up in the evening.
If they catch their 16,000 tons, how many fish will that be? Have you done the math yet?
Well, not exactly, because it depends on the average weight.
Okay.
And so we're looking at a little bit higher average weight this year. But my guess is in the 50 million fish range.
Tim Sands, area management biologist for the west side of Bristol Bay, wrapping up herring probably within the weekend. Tim, thanks so much. Or wrapping up purse seine, rather.
Right.
Probably this weekend. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Glad to have you with us on Bristol Bay and Beyond. I'm Dave Benninger. Thursday marked the end of a court-imposed stay in a lawsuit between EPA and Pebble. The two sides said they need another week to work out their differences outside of court. Thursday was also the day that Nunamta Alukastai announced it had fired Kim Williams as executive director, saying she was signing on with Pebble. I called CEO Tom Collier to see what he could update us on with this controversial project. There's news this week that one of your long, staunch opponents has been removed from Nunaamta Lukastai, supposedly to work for a Pebble advisory group. Is there anything you can talk about with us yet?
Well, I have a couple things I can say. We're very interested in putting together a Pebble Advisory Council to help us think about what kind of project we should go forward with, and even more importantly, if we go forward with one, how we ought to make sure that it is received well in the region. What do we need to do? Should we really talk about delivering electricity to the region? What can we do with the fishing community? What can we do in terms of revenue sharing with the residents there? What can we do in terms of employment, contracting commitments? And so all of that, we want to pull together some folks from Alaska and from the rest of the country that have been maybe skeptical about the project, maybe been adversaries, some that have maybe been supportive, but a fair group that can advise me as we move forward. I really am eager to get this advisory council established, but I'm not prepared to talk about any individuals that may be on it at this point, but hope that I can in another week or so.
All right. We'll follow up in that week or so. It sounds like it certainly will be interesting to people. Thursday became an important date in the saga of Pebble v. EPA because of an imposed stay on the EPA's efforts that was set to lapse. Can you update us on what has occurred at this point, legally speaking?
So we began negotiations with the government. Actually, we'd been negotiating for a while, but they became fairly intense 45 days ago when we requested the court to extend a stay that was in place at the time for 45 days because we thought we'd be able to reach some kind of settlement, some kind of resolution that would allow us to go into what we call normalized permitting, file a permit application and have the Corps of Engineers do an environmental impact statement and so forth. And today was the expiration of that 45 days, and we're not quite there. So we've requested another week, and I'm quite optimistic that within that week we're going to be able to deliver a resolution. And I want to emphasize that, you know, all the resolution allows us to do is to go into permitting. So we'll prepare a permit application and file it, and everyone will have an opportunity to look at the project we're proposing, which, by the way, I think will be dramatically different from what most people think we have been talking about proposing in the past. And I think that we're going to get this opportunity here within the next week. I think we'll resolve this and work it out and file a motion with the court that will dismiss all of our litigation and let us just focus on going into permitting like every other company has been able to do in the 40-something year history of the Clean Water Act.
What do you think that will result in the work EPA did for 6 or 7 years that culminated in the Bristol Bay Watershed Assessment and those proposed wastewater dredge and fill restrictions?
Well, you know, we've always thought that the Obama administration, EPA, engaged in an effort to decide they wanted to kill our project and to manipulate the process in order to make that happen. I think the Bristol Bay Watershed Assessment was a document that's not worth the paper that it's printed on. Its scientific value is zero. And I think that as we move forward, we're going to file a specific application for a permit with a very well-defined project, dramatically different from anything that EPA looked at in the BBWA. We'll have an environmental impact statement with every expert in the country that wants to comment being able to do so. And out of that, we'll see whether we get a permit or not. We think we will. But I think that the Bristol Bay watershed assessment was a joke. And I think that's what the court would have found if we continued our litigation. But I think the new administration has decided that you should only initiate a veto process when you have a full record, a full environmental impact statement in front of you, which has been the case in every single other situation throughout the entire history of the statute. This is the only time that EPA has ever decided to do a veto without even having a permit application, a mine plan in front of it. And it's absurd. And so what we're going to do is just go into normalized permitting. We got a long way to go. We got a lot of people to convince that this makes sense, but we're ready to start that process.
There's a lot of folks who think that those promises have been made to submit a permit and a plan many times in the past that weren't met. Are you committed to say that this could happen in a time frame of this year?
So, you know, to those folks who've said that, I have to say to them, you're right. You know, we've said this before. And market conditions, investment realities, price of metals have caused us to have to reconsider that. And, you know, who knows whether that might happen again. But I'll tell you this, I'm driving my team daily to get ready to file a permit application this year. And I'm going to start within the next few weeks talking about the specific mine plan that we have in mind, and people will get a chance to decide whether that makes sense or not.
Sounds like we'll have things to talk about here in the near future again with you. Tom Collier is the CEO of Pebble Mine, joining us by phone from what sounds like a windy sidewalk in the nation's capital. Thank you for the time this afternoon. Southwest Alaska, spring brings geese, and in Igiagig, geese bring goose camp. It's a three-day culture camp for the Yupa community that lives on the south side of Iliamna Lake at the mouth of the Kwijak River. Across the river from town, a now defunct lodge sits on top of a hill. The owners of the land allow goose camp. In return, campers clean up a portion of the grounds each year. We send KDLG's Avery Lill up to have a look this week, and she brought back this story.
Everyone's ready?
Yep.
When we smash these, you want to be careful because you don't want the paint to fly everywhere. Oh. Yeah, you want to keep it on your rock.
It's a bright May morning. Igiagig's elementary schoolers sit in a circle crushing brittle red rocks between two larger stones. At the center of the circle, archaeologist Monty Rogers explains that this is the way that people in the area have made paint for thousands of years.
I'd probably go with the oral histories and that folks have been here longer than 8,000 years. So that's a really long time. And so that whole time, people have been wanting to paint. I mean, what do you think they made paint out of?
Rocks, berries.
What else?
Oh, they made paint that tastes good probably from the berries.
Yeah, I bet.
The painting lesson is a highlight for Igiagig's youngest set. Rogers leads the kids to a map of the area pinned to the side of one of the old buildings. Colored arrows point to places with Yupik and Dena Ina place names.
So in this map, the color of the arrow means the color of the paint, where they could go get it. So red arrows is associated with red paint.
Mine comes good. Hey, there's blue. Red under our thing.
Right. So.
Then Rogers passes out strips of birch bark. John Alvarez is 8 years old. He adds water to the red powder he's crushed. Hunched over the bark in concentration, he uses a twig that he's collected to draw a stick figure. He carefully holds the bark flat so that the watery paint will not run.
I drew a man and he got hit and he's fat.
What'd you draw him with?
Rock paint.
Later in the day, Rogers will teach the middle and high school students to make uluwaks and knives out of slate. This is the fourth year of Goose Camp. The initiative started with instructors at Igiagig's small school. Tate Gooden is the head teacher.
I wanted to start a place-based education activity, kind of centered around something that was culturally responsive and based on the geese that explode down here in the spring. you know, we have the little kids watching the big kids, and the big kids watch everybody watching the elders and sharing jobs and stories. And one of our hopes is that, you know, this is kind of a leadership camp.
The loose theme this year is Yupik Language Arts and Crafts. For the language portion, the students gather for a quick Yupik lesson.
Ilunga, seasons, we have Oksumi.
Alex Anna Salmon is the president of the Ikiagig Village Council, and she's been overseeing a language revitalization program for the past couple of years. She's been learning the Lake Eliamna dialect of Yupik from the few elders who still speak it fluently. She in turn helps teach it to the school kids. After they've run through their vocabulary, she gives them a list of items spelled out in Yupik, things like feathers and rocks that the students collect around camp. She challenges them to call each other by their Yupik names for the rest of the day. In between the themed activities, there's time for hiking, gathering snails, duck hunting, log splitting, fire building, and, as 13-year-old Kaylee Hill relates, camp shenanigans.
One morning we were laying in our tent, minding our own business, when one of the boys, Keelan, he ran and opened our tent and threw a bunch of rabbit poop on us and ran away.
But rabbit poop was not enough to scare anyone back across the river. The second and final night wrapped up with the annual chili cook-off, singing and dancing.
This is a song about all of the mosquitoes in Ikiagig and how we constantly try to smack them.
The vision of Goose Camp is to give students a chance to practice skills people around Lake Eliamna have used for centuries, skills that are still useful in Ikiagig today. Salmon explains that Goose Camp is more than just a getaway, and it's even more than just a time to learn to paint, start a fire, or say words in Yupik.
In the Western worldview, you own a place. I'm here. This place is named after me, and I own it. And for the Yupik way, it's you belong there. That's the place of land where you belong. And the very word for happiness stems from that. When you're happy, you know where you're in the right place and you're content.
The dancers swat at imaginary mosquitoes around their faces as they sing about the place to which they belong. In Ikiagig, I'm Avery Lill.
Thanks for staying with us this week. Well, the soundbite of the week we're going to give to DPD Chief Dan Pascarello, who described how a heroin dealing case was adjudicated this way.
In the criminal justice system, the people are represented by two separate yet equally important groups, the police who investigate crimes and the district attorneys who prosecute the offenders. Once we as police turn our...
The chief can occasionally be quite the ham, quoting from Law & Order there. Well, Law & Order is something that we like to cover here on KDLG. Not long ago on this show, we introduced you to the new Superior Court Judge, Tina Ray. When she was promoted from magistrate, Clerk of Court Tanya O'Connor stepped in as an interim in the magistrate role. As of Thursday, O'Connor is now officially and formally both. I was happy to have her join me yesterday to discuss. Good to have you in the studio. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So explain first, this is a rather new position for the court system.
Brand new.
And this is a budget savings measure, or what do you explain?
After Judge Ray was appointed as Superior Court Judge, administration took a look at the number of cases we had filed, looked at some other cost-saving measures, and looked at how we could still, you know, service the public. And one of the ideas that came out of administration was to change my position to Magistrate Judge, Clerk of Court.
Which we'll point out now that is something you have filled in as magistrate for a decade or more now.
So I was hired in late 2007, as deputy clerk. Early 2008, like the beginning of the year, I was hired as Clerk of Court. At that time, I started what we call magistrate lessons. I was assigned training judge. I went through extensive training because I hear people say, wow, you're on the bench, you're not a lawyer. No, there's many many magistrates in the state who are not. So I started.
Some would probably say for the better.
Started my training. That was almost a year with lessons and training and working with my training judge. I started doing weekend duty. So, and I've also had questions, wow, now you're just on the bench. But unless you've been in jail on a Saturday morning,
you probably don't know
right. that I've been sitting on the bench, or at 8 o'clock at night, someone needs a protective order or an arrest warrant or, you know, whatever. So it's nothing new. I'm just in the light Monday through Friday now.
Right. And even as a clerk of court, you're intimately familiar with our court, our issues, our people, our law enforcement. You've interacted hundreds of times in all these situations. These are things you're very familiar with.
Yes.
What part of this job makes you nervous off the bat?
I think being in the light Monday through Friday. I've gotten used to who my audience, for lack of a better word, who they are on the weekend. It's usually troopers, sometimes a DA on the phone, defendants, sometimes same people. Not a lot of public showing up for, you know, public hearings. So it's going to take me a while. I'm nervous in public. I was public speaking, so.
What makes you confident that you're the right fit for the job?
Well, I know the process. I understand the rules. I know how to find the answer to a rule or a penalty. I know where to find all the information. So it, for lack of a better word, I mean, it's cut and dry. And SB 91 has also, and it's also made things cut and dry. There's not a lot of wiggle room anymore.
I'm sure a lot of people think they could probably do the job, but I want to ask you before we let you go about an experience this week, which is that a defendant was before you. He had just been arrested on a charge and agreed to be open sentenced, meaning he put his case in your hands to make a determination, and he was sentenced to a flat year in jail. I don't think anybody who thinks they might be able to do this job can probably not understand what that must be like to send a person to jail until they've been there. Can I ask you, not about that case in particular, but just about that moment, did something kind of click?
It's tough. I mean, anyone who says it's not tough, and I don't know a magistrate or a judge who doesn't have a moment or a time on the bench where things aren't tough, but there's rules to follow and there's things that need to be done. Did it make me sick to my stomach? Yes. You know, I've heard, you know, in 10 years, I mean, I've heard people sentenced to 399 years, and it made me sick to my stomach to hear it. So I have a job to do. It's what I've been hired to do. There's rules to follow, and that's what I'll do. And this, you know, what the state's doing, what administration's doing, we've been very proactive. We were proactive 3 years ago when finances were looking bad, and we start doing furlough days, and we do furlough days on Friday, half days now, all across the state. But we're not laying people off, and people are not losing their jobs, and we'll continue to find cost savings and still, under the Constitution, give service where we need to. So,
right,
do our jobs.
Tanya O'Connor is the magistrate judge and clerk of court in Dillingham. It's now official. Tanya, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
And that's just about it for this week's show. You can find this and past episodes of Bristol Bay and Beyond at our website, kdlg.org. Send feedback and story ideas to Dave at kdlg.org. My thanks to Avery Lill and Lawrence Hamilton for their help this week. Well, spring is here. Graduations and proms will happen here shortly, and somebody's going to call us in a week or two and tell us they have a first red in the net. We hope you get out there and enjoy it. I'm Dave Benninger. Yesterday, I snuck backstage as the Dillingham Drama Club was in the midst of a dress rehearsal for Annie. We'll leave you with this week with an audio postcard from behind the scenes. Hi there. Yes. What's your name?
Guess. Anne.
What's your last name, Anne?
Tucker.
And what?
Guess what she's playing?
An orchestra. orphan?
Yes.
Do you have any lines?
Mama, mommy.
That's perfect. Are you nervous?
Guess who she is.
Yes.
Have you been on stage before?
Yes.
So you're going to nail it.
Yes.
Good luck.
Thank you.
I'm Logan Ball, and I'm doing backstage, directing backstage, and then makeup. And I've also painted the sets.
So when the audience shows up this weekend, if you could call their attention to either one makeuped face or painted stage prop, what would you say, this is my proudest achievement?
Probably the orphanage that I painted. I really liked how that one turned out.
You painted that?
Mm-hmm.
Can you give me your most ecstatic line?
Yes, sir.
That's it?
Yeah.
What's your best line?
That one.
That's it?
Yeah.
Well, don't forget it.
I'm Oakley Beetle, and my role is Mr. Bundle's the laundry man, a homeless person, a street cop, and a Secret Service agent.
Of all those, what's your favorite role?
Being Mr. Bundle's, because I get to flirt with Miss Hannigan.
This is a huge debate on Star Wars.
Is this what people do backstage?
More or less, yeah. We've had random debates on whatever.
I'm Robin, and I play Pepper.
Robin who?
Robin K. Savo.
Okay. And what's your favorite line?
Shut up.
Shut up?
Yeah.
Or are you just telling me that?
No, it's my actual line. I'm like in the play, I'm kind of snobby and mad all the time.
My name is Nikki, and I am the apple seller and a policeman.
You have any stage fright?
No.
What do you do as the apple seller?
I sell apples.
Okay, you guys are behind the scenes types here.
I run the big lights up there and behind on backstage, and I have like the past 4 or 5 years, something like that.
Okay.
And I learned Chris Marks, and I'm the only person who can do it right now.
And your name is?
Sawyer Sands.
Do you feel like the guys behind the scenes get enough credit for their making?
Yeah, you know, if people like to play, then it's good enough.
And?
Well, I'm Sam Calvert, and I do the spotlight. I've only been doing it for a year now, and it's pretty fun.
Like, ready for this weekend?
Yep, I hope so.
What's your name?
Alex Buholm, and my character is July.
And what are you going to be doing as July?
It's like, Annie, Miss Hannigan's going to catch you and give you the paddle.
I'm Dakota McDowell, and I do makeup for most of the cast.
Are you proud of your work? Describe who we're standing next to here. I don't think she has this many freckles in real life.
She actually does. Those are her actual freckles. It's supposed to be Lily, and she is the con man's wife. And so her makeup is supposed to be kind of sophisticated, but kind of sloppy, kind of not really put together, but not in a drunken kind of way. Like, I'm trying to...
And did you nail it?
Yes.
Directors, are we a go? Are we green light?
We are.
It
this
never
is
looks
like a train on the track, so once it gets going, you can't stop it.
I really like everything, like the dances, the music, and I like hanging out with my friends here too. It's pretty fun.
I am Bert Healy, the radio announcer. So I'm basically you in the 30s.
Can we hear your best 1930s radio voice in the sample here?
All right, well, let's try this. This is Mrs. Healy's boy, Bert, saying good night. Same station, same time, next week. Thank you.
Nice work, man.